From your world news headquarters on the World Wide Web, it's time for your daily dose of sanity. This is the Maria Heller Show. Maria Heller is a published author, founder of the Universal Wheel, a lifestyle and philosophy based on our interconnectedness to all living things, a Reiki master, and delivers the news with spiritual views. How many intuitive news decoders, animal rights activists, and vegetarian broadcasters are there? Just one, Maria. Maria has provided independent news for a smart audience for over 13 years now on the Maria Heller Show, available at maria.net.
M-E-R-I-A.net.
And now, here is your host, the mouth that roars, Maria Heller.
Good morning, world. Maria here, alive and kicking. How's everybody doing out there? Welcome to Send In the Clowns with my excellent co-host, Dave McGowan. Dave, good morning. I see your book on Laurel Canyon's getting a second wind. What's going on?
I don't know. I'm not sure what to make of that, you know? I mean, it had a really good run, and it's been out for, what, like, I think 9 months now, maybe a little longer. And, you know, I mean, books have a relatively, even best-selling books have a relatively short, you know, shelf life. And, you know, it's out with the old and in with the new, because there's, you know, constantly new batches of books coming out. So, I thought I'd pretty much ridden that wave as far as I could, and it was a good ride. But, you know, I was reconciled myself to the fact that it was probably over, you know, but, you know, my direct sales had slowed way down, and I could tell by the Amazon sales figures that, you know, sales in general had gone down, and I wasn't getting any more interview requests, really, and, you know, but I figured, well, you know, that's just to be expected, you know, but now it seems to have caught a second wind, and now I'm getting new orders. I've sent out 3 or 4 books in the last few days. I got one sitting right here that's going out today, and the Amazon sales figures have picked up, and got a half a dozen new interview requests. This is the third one that I've done in the last week, and I have 3 more scheduled over the course of the next week or so, and yeah, it seems to be catching a second wind, and my publisher contacted me a few days ago to tell me that one of the parties who had expressed interest in film rights way back when it first came out, you know, I'd gotten several inquiries from I don't know, 4 different people.
Wow, that's great.
Who had expressed initial interest in possibly developing as a TV or a film project, and that had all kind of died out, and you know, hadn't had any follow up on any of that. And my publisher just got back to me a few days ago and said that one of them had finally taken them a month to do it, but they had finally signed and sent out a 6-month option agreement, seeking a 6-month option to develop the project. So,
fabulous.
Yeah, it seems like it's caught a second wind here in just the last, just since the new year started. So I'm
good. Well,
very pleasantly surprised by that.
Good for you. Well, I think it'd make an excellent film. You know, it's interesting. I don't know.
I'm skeptical. I have very little confidence that they're going to treat, you know, if the project ever gets off the ground, that they're going to treat the material in the way that I would like to see it treated. But I guess time will tell.
Well, I'm reading a new book. I believe the title is Hidden History. By a guy, I think his last name is Jeffries. He takes the conspiracies through the decades in the United States. It's a fabulous book. And he goes, you know, through the Kennedy assassination and all the way up. You know, I'm only like 1/3 through. It's excellent. But he actually, yesterday when I was reading through it, he mentions you and your work. I didn't even know if you knew that you were in this guy's book or not. So
I
saw your name on the page, I underlined it, and I said, Dave McGowan, I'll have to remember to tell Dave. So I don't remember exactly how and what he's referring to, but obviously he's read some of your work without question. But it's nice when I see some of my co-host names in other people's books.
Yeah, I was not aware of that.
The next time I actually, the next time I remember, I'll get it because I read that at the gym. So the next time I go in my gym bag, I'll send you the title of the book. Eventually, I'll have them on the show. It's a great book. It's smoking hot.
I'm supposed to do some TV show thing next week, one day next week I'm supposed to do some kind of TV show. It's an internet-based TV. It's a fairly new internet-based TV network called Lip TV or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And this guy's launching a brand new show on that network, and he wants me to come on sometime next week. I don't know when it is. I think it's next week or maybe it's the following week to be his very first guest.
Wow.
On his brand new, newly launched, he wants me to be his first guest on his premiere episode. So that's kind of new and different, and something I've definitely never done before. I'd actually have to go down there, have to go down to some studio over in the West Side and actually be on camera for an interview, which is a whole new thing for me. So
I'm sure you'll do great.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. And then next month I'm supposed to do this coffee shop talk thing with some guy, which is another whole new experience where he does this monthly thing where he brings in various people from various walks of life. He's talked to film directors and actors and authors and social activists and various people, and it's sort of a live interview in front of an audience. He's been set up on a stage, and it's sort of like inside the actor's studio sort of thing. And questions and probably take questions from the audience, I suppose. And
good. So, just enjoy
it. Coming up, too. So I got two completely new and different things that I've never done before where I actually had to show my face to
But that's life, you know. So, be happy. You get to enjoy different and new experiences, you know. We're here to experience. Why not? You know, the world needs to know what you know, what I know, you know. I think that he might have referred to you in that book on your Wagging the Moondog series, which I've been posting a lot of on social media lately because this story's back in the news, you know, especially where we're supposed to believe that I don't remember who the hell's house, one of the astronauts where they supposedly found all kinds of swag that he supposedly stole from the moon that was all found in his house. I don't know if you saw that or not.
Yeah, I did see that. Yeah, it was all stuff that was supposedly left behind on the moon, but it showed up in like Neil Armstrong's attic or something. I don't know.
Right, and I'm sure. Oh, that I'm sure for sure that's what he was talking about, because that's what I'm pretty sure he was talking about your work on the moon series and how it was bullcrap, comparing it to Kubrick's 2001 and all the similarities.
My last interview that I just did a couple days ago, which I thought was supposed to be about weird scenes, like three quarters of the interview ended up being about the Apollo. That's the guy was. That's what he was primarily seemed to want to talk about. So okay,
yeah. Well, hey, you know, I keep referring people to it.
That seems to be getting a lot of traction lately.
Oh, there you go. More traction than we saw in the 60s on the moon, that's for sure. Anyway, let's skip from the moon and let's get back to Lincoln. You just sent me, I don't think you've posted it yet, your latest work on Lincoln.
I haven't posted it yet. It still needs a lot of cleanup and it's not even quite finished. I've been in transition for several weeks now. Primarily, mostly what I've done the last month is sort, pack, move, and unpack and put away. It's been a long, grueling process, so I have not had much time at all to devote to it, unfortunately. But now that I'm settled back in, I'm hopefully going to get back on a regular schedule with the Lincoln, start getting more Lincoln posts up there.
Well, you know, what you sent me on Lincoln, you still there? Because your phone was kind of a little weird.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, just getting some hollow sounds. One of the things that I looked at, you know, reading your latest work, which people will, you have my listeners, of course, had the benefit of hearing it today, was how many people aided and abetted the supposed assassin, and yet very few of them, if any, were punished. I mean, there were teams of people supposedly, you know, helping in the grand escape with John Wilkes Booth and David Herold. I was stunned by how many people, even when at one point a whole bunch of them got arrested and then they were all released.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's amazing, you know. I mean, you know, the authorities led what was, you know, billed as the biggest manhunt of all time, you know, looking for these people and, you know, supposedly leaving no stone unturned and, you know, wanted posters that explicitly warned people that anyone offering any aid and comfort to the fugitives would be subjected to prosecution and punishment of death. That, you know, anybody that foolish enough, brazen enough to offer aid and assistance to these people were putting their life on the line. And, you know, we've already discussed how ridiculously biased the quote-unquote trial for the conspirators was, you know, and how aggressively and illegally they prosecuted the people that they did, you know, prosecute for their supposed involvement. And yet, you know, it was known that some, like, two dozen people, just this long list of names, supposedly offered him aid and comfort all, you know, throughout the entire, like, 2 weeks that they were on the lam. You know, they would be given shelter and food and transportation and everything else. And yet none of these people were ever prosecuted for these supposed crimes, with the exception of Dr. Mudd. And, who actually, you know, who had a legitimate reason for his supposed involvement. You know, I mean, this stranger comes knocking on his door in the middle of the night with a, you know, supposedly broken leg, needing medical assistance, and, you know, by the Hippocratic Oath, he's bound to, you know, provide this guy with medical care. And And for that, he was prosecuted and sent to prison, you know, and yet all these other people who were far more involved, you know, according to the official story anyway, were never, they were arrested and then quickly released and never charged or prosecuted.
Right, but wasn't it Dr. Mudd who actually said that it wasn't John Wilkes Booth?
Yeah, he knew him from before, and he said that he absolutely did not recognize the man that he treated as John Wilkes Booth, and also, when shown pictures of David Herold, could not identify David Herold as the as his companion. And he swore up and down that it was not Booth and Herold that had visited him that evening.
Well, maybe that's why he went to jail.
And then you have Ned Spangler, you know, who all he did supposedly was hold the reins of Booth's horse, you know, behind Ford's Theater, which he may or may not have even done. And even if he did do, you know, he wouldn't, you know, that was part of his job as an employee of the theater. You know, he was the theater handyman kind of guy, you know, carpenter, handyman, scene shifter kind of guy. And, you know, he was just expected to do those kind of odd jobs around the theater. And so even if he did do it, you know, there's no indication that he knew that this was any night any different than any other. And he was just doing, you know, the job that he was supposed to do. And yet he was very aggressively prosecuted and sentenced and, you know, sent off to some remote prison. And yet all these other people that you know, again, were knowingly, you know, very, very knowingly supplied aid and comfort to aid in the escape, you know, of these two, were let slide. So, yeah, right. You know, the whole story just, once again, just does not add up.
Right. Well, you know, the last time we talked about this, we described in great detail that the box that Lincoln was sitting in had a broken lock on it. It had a wedge cut in it, you know, a piece of wood there to lock him in. We covered that, but I think that what's important, and, you know, there was so much in this last piece you sent me. I know we had talked about that as being odd and unusual. We kind of briefly mentioned that the telegraph service, which was like their internet at the time, was down for 2 hours, but they didn't make a big deal over that. How convenient. But I did not know, if we talked about it, I forgot, that the gas was also turned off, which was what their streetlights were lit up with. So everybody was literally in the dark.
No, we did not talk about that. I only recently discovered that. I was not aware of that before this most recent installment. But, yeah, that was another unexplained, very unusual circumstance that not only did the telegraph system go down, I mean, almost precisely at the time that Lincoln was shot, the telegraph system mysteriously went down and remained down for 2 to 3 hours, you know, at the worst possible time, but also someone turned off the gas lamps along, specifically along the route that Booth used to escape from Ford Theater to the Navy Yard Bridge, his path out of town. The gas lights had mysteriously been turned off, so, you know, plunging his escape route into darkness. So,
right.
You know, that was very convenient also. And yeah, as you mentioned, the locks had been broken on Lincoln's box. The spy hole had been drilled in the door at eye level so that someone approaching the box could look in and survey the circumstances that they were walking into before they entered, and, you know, the wedge had been left behind to wedge the door shut, and, you know, all this stuff had been left there in preparation. And, you know, of course, historians will tell you that John Wilkes Booth was there earlier in the day and did all that himself, you know, broke the locks and drilled the hole and fashioned this. But there's no evidence. There's no witnesses that saw him do it. There's no evidence that he actually did it. They just claim that he did because they don't know how else to explain it, you know?
Right. Well, how else could he make such a clean getaway?
A lot of things that just fell into place that night.
All right, lucky him.
The lack of a bodyguard who just happened to wander off his post, and, the hole in the door and the broken locks and the telegraph system going down and the lighting system going down, and I mean, a whole lot of things just seemed to happen at just exactly the right time, you know, that John Wilkes Booth could not possibly have had control over all of that stuff. So there were clearly other people in power that were, you know, working behind the scenes to facilitate this.
Right. I don't know how anybody can say that there wasn't a conspiracy. You know, there's no way a guy with a single, you know, what did he have on him, a Derringer, just leaps out, shoots the president, leaps out of the theater, a fully packed theater. There just happens to be a horse, happens to be no lights in the street, happens to be no telegrams that can be sent for 2 hours, and they kind of blew that off. How can anybody believe the, this was the beginning of the lone nut conspiracies in this country.
And the guard, Silas Cobb, the guard at the Navy Yard Bridge, just happened to let, but not just Booth, but both of them separately pass over the bridge, despite the fact that it had been closed for several hours due to a curfew imposed during the war. For security purposes, and yet, for some reason they were both allowed to pass, and, that was never questioned. And again, just as we see now when something like 911 happens and it's written off as a intelligence failure, and yet we don't see no one gets fired, no one gets prosecuted, you know, there's no repercussions for any of these people who supposedly dropped the ball. And we see the exact same thing with Lincoln, you know, there was no repercussions for Parker, the security guy, for abandoning his post, leaving the president wide open. There were no repercussions for Cobb for letting these two guys pass out of the city, you know, over a bridge that was supposed to be closed. He had no reason whatsoever to let them pass over. And, you know, on and on and on. It's just, you know, throughout the whole story, you just find these same themes that we find today.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, you know, even when you look at these supposed events, like anything from the Boston bombing to the bombing in Paris or this recent one in Copenhagen. It's always one guy, okay? One guy, no problem, we killed him, move on. And I think that this really started, I mean, maybe it was even happening before Lincoln's assassination, but I think this is where they set the MO for all future events.
It seems like it. I mean, it's just remarkable how many parallels there are and, just how many lucky breaks, the John Wilkes Booth supposedly caught and, you know, how many doors were left open for him and yet, nothing, you know, no official action taken for, you know, any of these lapses that, various people, you know, supposedly were responsible for.
Right, and it surely seems like there was no autopsy either on Booth.
There wasn't. There was, it was a joke. The guy was buried within 40 hours of his death, and that was including transporting the body back from Garrett's barn to D.C. and loading him aboard the Montauk. where supposedly he was going to be autopsied. And, according to some writers, this was a very meticulous process and, they left no stone unturned and it was absolutely positively identified as John Wilkes Booth, but, that's not even close to being the truth. Actually they deliberately excluded various people who could have positively identified Booth from even viewing the body. No family members were allowed to view it. None of his fellow actors or theater people. None of his co-defendants, co-conspirators, supposedly, even though they were being held prisoner on that very same ship. Mm-hmm. And so all the people that they had identify him were government operatives, pretty much.
Right, insiders.
They're all War Department personnel. Mm-hmm. And then they very quickly, he was only on the boat, on the ship for just like hours. Literally, he got on there in the morning and supposedly they, did this formal identification and autopsy. And then the body was hustled right back off the ship and into a secret grave somewhere, never to be seen again. And, there were questions raised in Congress. You know, there was a congressional committee that questioned, whether Booth was in fact captured or killed. serious questions raised about that, even within official circles about, whether Booth was in fact killed at Garrett's barn. And if so, why they so hastily, disposed of the body and did not have witnesses who were readily available. You know what I mean? There were all kinds of people in Washington, D.C. who could have positively identified John Wilkes Booth, including the co-conspirators and all of the, all of the actors from Ford's Theater and Grover's Theater there in D.C. and family members. And, a lot of people that could, in fact, have positively said, yes, this is John Wilkes Booth, and none of them were allowed to see the body.
Even though it was his brother's picture that was on the wanted posters.
Yeah.
It wasn't even his picture. Doesn't it remind you of how they dump Bin Laden's body supposedly in the ocean with no pictures, no evidence, no witnesses, nothing?
Very, very much so. And then they just tell us, that we just have to take it on faith that the government's telling us the truth, I don't see much reason for doing that.
Right. They didn't tell us the truth 200 years ago. Why would they tell us the truth now? They've only had more time to perfect their system of conspiracy.
Exactly. So, it's... But yeah, there were questions raised at the time. There were any number of people who were very suspicious of the government's contention that John Wilkes Booth had been killed in Garrett's barn. And it wasn't unusual to put bodies on public display in those days.
Right.
Notorious criminals and even well beyond that, into the Wild West days, you see pictures to this day, old vintage photographs of these bodies like on display, you know, like propped up in caskets in front of the sheriff's office or in the town square or whatever, because, you know, I mean, it was a very different time back then. It seems very morbid to us now.
Right, or leave them hanging as
unusual,
a warning.
You know, someone like a Jesse James or a Billy the Kid or whatever, you know, that they would put the body, you know, some very notorious outlaw that, you know, they would put them on display.
Of course, warning. I know.
Nothing like that.
How long, how many weeks did they drive around Lincoln's body throughout the country? I mean, that went on forever.
They took him out on tour and had multiple, you know, I mean, they had the big, you know, funeral in the rotunda, and then they took him around the country by train. It's all over the place, and made quite a big deal out of that.
Right. So, you know, it's illogical that they wouldn't want to do the same with John Wilkes Booth. And if they knew he was in the barn, supposedly, and the barn only locked from the inside, why wouldn't they have tried to capture him? Wouldn't that have been even more effective to capture the man that killed the president?
Yeah, that was another question, is why, you know, they had some two dozen heavily armed, you know, posse members that were surrounding this barn, and, you know, why could they not have taken this guy alive and had him answer a lot of questions that remain unanswered to this day because he was supposedly gunned down. So, you know, I mean, that's another question, is why, you know, if he was gunned down, why wasn't he taken alive? And then the question of, you know, whether it was even John Wilkes Booth.
Right. Well, wasn't the barn burned down?
The barn was burned down, yeah.
So, well, you know,
I don't know if it burned down completely, but it was lit on fire to drive them out, yeah.
So I wonder if the body was burnt or not, because then you'd never know who it was. It wasn't like they had forensics back in those days.
Yeah, that's true, you know. The point is there are numerous things they could have done that would have put any questions to rest about whether this was in fact John Wilkes Booth. They could have photographed the body. Well, they did photograph the body. One of the most well-known photographers of the time is Alexander Gardner, the same guy who took the very iconic, well, you know, the glamour shots of the conspirators, and the guy who photographed their hanging and photographed Lincoln's funeral and everything else. He was very much involved in this whole operation, and he did take the only known photo of the body, which then promptly disappeared and has never to this day been seen publicly. But you know, I mean, there's at least three different things they could have done. They could have put the body on display if they really wanted to. They could have released photographs of the body, or they could have had people that actually knew him that would be believed, you know, about, you know, like family members and, you know, fellow actors and whatnot, vouch for the fact that it was, in fact, John Wilkes Booth, and they didn't do any of those things. So it definitely raises a lot of questions about who was actually shot in Garrett's barn.
Right. Could have just been some poor horseshoeing bastard who ended up with a couple of bullets in him, and they passed him off at John Wilkes Booth. Dave, we're going to take a short break. When we get back, we have got to tell the story of the horses, because that, I was laughing out loud with that. So stay with us. Dave and I will be right back.
Wow. One solid hour of commercial-free information thanks to you. The person who wants truth has the integrity and understanding to support it with your donation and subscription. Greer believes people can handle the truth and delivers it tirelessly with those with ears to listen. 14 years on the net. Won't you take a moment right now to commit to a subscription of your choice at www.maria.net. That's MERIA.net. Over 1,100 hours of pure education all in one place, 24/7, and all downloadable. Knowledge is power. Sharing that knowledge is wisdom. Together we can change the world and create real hope. Now let's get back to the Maria Heller Show.
Okay, welcome back to Send in the Clowns. And let me tell you, the clowns have obviously been in charge of this country since day one, without question of a doubt. Anytime, Dave, I see a movie about any kind of time travel, you're the first person that comes into my head. I'm like, oh, God, if we could only have sent Dave there. Oh, if Dave could only have been here or there. Dave, as I'm reading this latest piece you sent me, we get to the fact that these two men, whoever the hell they were on horseback. They managed to do things on horseback that is as phenomenal to believe as the fuel from airplanes took down the World Trade Center. They meet up 8 miles away. They go to Mary Surratt's, you know, probably get drunk, get laid, whatever. And then they're driving away, and of course they go to Dr. Mudd, who said it wasn't them. Okay, he goes to jail. And then you get to the point of, as these guys are, you know, wheeling and dealing, taking ferries, you know, charging around America on horseback, all of a sudden the horses have disappeared. Okay? What happened to the horses, and what were we supposed to believe with that story?
Yeah, that's one of the most ridiculous aspects of the whole story. You know, what's agreed upon is that they obviously had horses when they left the Mud residence. You know, they had a mode of transportation. And then supposedly they hooked up with this group of guys down in the swamps of Maryland, Thomas Jones, and I don't remember the names, they're all in the thing, but these people that supposedly helped them out and agreed to hide them in a pine thicket, which they supposedly stayed in for the better part of a week, just hiding out in this pine thicket. And, you know, because there was a massive manhunt going on, they had to be very careful about not revealing their location. So they couldn't, for example, light a fire. You know, they couldn't do anything that would tip off any passing patrols to their location. So one thing historians agree on is that they absolutely would have had to get rid of the horses, because the horses would have given them away in various ways. So it's generally agreed that they had to have gotten rid of the horses during these 5-6 days that they spent in chilling out in the Maryland swamp, supposedly, in this pine thicket. But the problem is that historians have struggled very hard to explain how exactly you get rid of 2,000-plus-pound horses along with all of their bridles and saddles and gear and everything else. And historians also will tell you that John Wilkes Booth was severely injured and couldn't even get up off the ground during the time there, so he was completely useless. So it fell upon David Harold, the sole responsibility for disposing of these horses.
Mm.
And there are two stories that are generally told, two that I've come across through all of my reading, with, you know, minor variations on the themes. But the two different stories are one that David Harold led them off into a clearing somewhere, shot them both, and then buried them so thoroughly that they were never found, never to be found, despite, you know, this massive manhunt, thousands of personnel combing the countryside looking for these people. No one ever found any sign of these horses. So, the two theories are one that he shot them and buried them, which is just completely ridiculous.
I know. Imagine digging a grave for that.
They had no tools at their disposal, you know. I mean, this guy supposedly dug a grave big enough to bury two horses with his bare hands, you know, and then somehow got these massive horse bodies into the graves, and then got them covered over so thoroughly that no one ever found them, you know, which is just absolutely ridiculous. But you will find accounts like that in these historical narratives told with a straight face that, you know, that's what happened.
Right. You would think they were written by, you'd think those books were written by Zane Grey. You know what I mean?
And the other explanation is even more ridiculous.
I know, that's the one that cracked me up.
He led them into a quicksand pit and just let them sink to their deaths.
Right.
And I looked this up, and other than in, you know, like TV and movie series from the 1960s, that doesn't actually happen. You know, that is a bit of popular folklore that there are quicksand pits that can, you know, literally swallow up an entire human body or animal carcass. Those things don't actually exist. That's something you'll see in an episode of Get Smart from the 60s, but in the real world, that doesn't actually happen, you know. So, and yet again, you have mainstream respected historians who will tell you with a straight face that that's exactly what happened. That David Harrell led them off into a quicksand pit, and they sunk deeply into the quicksand, never to be found again. You know, and even if that was possible, how are you going to go about leading two horses into a quicksand pit deep enough to swallow them up?
All right. Horses aren't stupid.
You toss a few chunks of horse kibble out and they're just good. I mean, how would you do that? It's like a cartoon, you know? I mean, you read these accounts and you're like, this doesn't happen in the real world. And yet you have these respected mainstream historians putting this stuff in their books and, you know, in school textbooks and popular works of nonfiction. And we're supposed to just read that and accept that as the truth. And
well, I could understand back in the day people being stupid, but these are not old books you're talking about. Some of the books you quote me are like 2003. You know what I'm saying? And people are still writing these fantasies.
They're still telling these stories about horses being swallowed up by quicksand because they have no other explanation of how two horses could have just vanished off the face of the earth. So they have to tell you that they were either buried or swallowed up by quicksand, and therefore they were never, to this day, there's never been any remains of these horses found, or the saddles or the bridles or any of the riding gear,
right,
anything connected to these horses has ever been found to this day.
Right.
And so they struggle to try to explain that away. I mean, sometimes they'll just pass over it. They just won't even mention it because, you know, you probably realize that they're going to sound like complete idiots, but a lot of them will just, you know, they'll just trot out these same stories that have been told for 150 years now,
and
expect the audiences to just eat that up. And
right, but if you look
I read it and just shake my head, I'm just like, how can anybody believe this for 150 years? I know.
If you think about it, when you watch those really old black and white westerns, okay, let's think, the Lone Ranger, okay? When they're on their horses, if a horse sees, you know, a snake on the ground, the horse starts backing up and tapping its foot, okay? Wouldn't you think a horse would do the same thing, wouldn't go lightly into a vat of quicksand?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the horse can, you know, be trained and be very obedient, but, you know, as I say in the thing, they're not stupid, you know, and no animal is going to willingly walk into a death trap, you know? I mean, they have instincts about these things, you know? I mean, every living organism has a very strong survival instinct and is going to fight tooth and nail to cling to life, you know? And a horse isn't just going to wander out, you know? And as soon as they step in, you know, start in there, they're going to realize, hey, something's wrong here. They're not just going to keep walking in until they're deep enough to completely
right,
submerge into a quick, I mean, it's just absolutely ridiculous. And then there's the fact that such quicksand pits apparently don't actually exist other than in popular fiction, you know. I mean, when's the last time you heard about someone, you know,
Indiana Jones
dying because
maybe Indiana Jones.
It's not something to make the news a lot these days. You know?
Well, you know, one of the things that I think is important, and you quoted it in your article, is you had a combined force, according to a book that you said Bill O'Reilly put his name on, a combined force of 700 Illinois cavalry, 600 members of the 22nd Colored Troops, and 100 men from the 16th New York Cavalry Regiment, through looking through this swamp 87 of them drowned looking for it. They never found anything. Now, if you know you've got 1,400 men scouring the area you're hiding out in, would you fire a weapon?
Yeah, that's a, shooting the horses, that's not going to attract, you know.
Right.
We have to get rid of the horses because if they start making noise, they're going to give us away. So let's shoot them. Cause
all right, and you know how sound travels in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah. So, that story is rather remarkable too. I don't know whether I believe that or not. That 87 of these 87 people drowned, just combing the countryside looking for them.
Maybe they fell into the quicksand.
Yeah, maybe. And I was gonna make a very. I was going to make a very offensive joke about that, actually, in my post, a reference to the, as you mentioned, that one of the groups that was doing the searching was the color division.
Right. Just the fact they called them the color division, I wouldn't have been looking for anybody.
I guess even in 1865, black people couldn't swim that well. But I figured that probably wouldn't go over too well.
Well, so. They were probably assassinated. That's my thought. Maybe they were running out of food and said, let's kill the colored people. Yeah, look, that story for another day. I think about Blazing Saddles. Reading this, I'm thinking about Blazing Saddles. So we move and groove, and these guys now have buried their horses, or their horses have choked, or maybe they ate them, okay? And yet they're still on the move, okay, without horses. So they find themselves next, I don't know, it's so hard to keep track of this, at a home of a lady named Elizabeth Quisenberry.
Well, first they had to cross the Potomac. They come out of the pine thicket, and then, they get further assistance from a couple other people. One of the local fishermen gives them a boat, to row across, supposedly.
Aiding and abetting.
More aiding and abetting.
Right.
And so they make a first attempt, but supposedly in the dark they get lost and confused and row the wrong way. And instead of rowing across the river, they row upriver and land upriver, still on the Maryland side of the Potomac. And so they failed their first attempt, supposedly, to get across. And then the next night, for reasons that have never been explained, they didn't make another effort. I don't know what I guess they just stayed back and partied that night. I don't know, whatever they're doing.
Maybe they realized that they were like Dumb and Dumber trying to steer a boat.
Yeah. And then on the third night, they finally supposedly made it across, and then they make their way to this Elizabeth Quisenberry's house, who quickly summoned several other people, a William Bryant and a Thomas Harbin, and I don't know who else. There's just people coming out of the woodwork to help these people everywhere they go, No, nobody's turning them in, nobody's providing any tips to authorities, they're all just offering aid and comfort. It's just ridiculous. But then they arrive at the Quisenberry's, and they're with these three soldiers, supposedly, these three young former Confederate soldiers, and from there then they make their way to Garrett's barn, where Booth stays, but David Harold supposedly rides on into Bowling Green with the other three, and they party and go to one guy's girlfriend's house or something and spend the night there. And I mean, there's just people all over the place just helping these people out,
Right. Well, if they didn't even look, if they were...
David Harold sleeping at somebody else's house, and you got people giving them boats, people bringing them food, blankets. It's this whole ridiculous scenario.
I'm thinking though, in those days it wasn't like they had phones or anything. If these two guys were never really identified, even by Dr. Mudd, as the people they were supposed to be, I could find it a little believable that people in the middle of nowhere, sort of like the people that aided and abetted Bonnie and Clyde, had no idea who these guys were. They might not even have known the president was killed, or they hated Lincoln. I mean, Lincoln was very well hated, too.
That is true. I mean, yeah, that's another thing that people don't realize is that John Wilkes Booth really, or whoever it was, is the guy that really made Lincoln this larger-than-life beloved figure, because before that, he was absolutely not. And it was only with his assassination that this sort of historical revisionism
became a saint.
Came into play, and now he's remembered as this beloved, almost godlike figure. Mm. But that was clearly not the case, during his lifetime and during his presidency.
Right. I mean, when George Bush, the idiot king, Jr., was in office and he was doing all the horrendous things from the Patriot Act to, talking about martial law, all this other stuff, I had said on my show, I'm no fan of the idiot king, but there was nothing he did that Lincoln didn't do as well. And yet most people have no idea.
Yeah, it's amazing how little people actually know about Lincoln and, some of the actions that he took, unconstitutional actions.
How many Americans he threw in gulags, right?
Without warrant and, shutting down newspaper offices that were critical of his administration and, revoking of habeas corpus and did all kinds of very similar to the stuff that was put out in the Patriot Act,
right? But everybody acted like Bush was the first one, and I'm reading that, and I was reading a lot of anti-Lincoln books at the time, which for whatever reason I couldn't get the authors to even agree to come on the show, so I said screw it, I'm not gonna keep reading this book. But when I looked at that, and I saw the similarities, not to give Bush a pardon, but I was like, he didn't do nothing that hasn't been done before.
He was not wildly popular at all.
No.
And took some very, very controversial actions, to say the least, and he was viewed as a tyrant, as, this out-of-control tyrant who was just running roughshod over the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, we just said something that might have just shocked everybody's sensibilities, especially right after President's Day, which is only now a good day to go shopping for linens. It's really, we live in such sick and twisted times. So who was it? And, we don't even know who the hell these two men were, because I'm not convinced either one of them was either Harold or John Wilkes Booth, because my sense is Booth left the country and had a great life in France. Who turned these guys in? And you very briefly mentioned somebody named Jett, who might have been one of the five guys they were hanging out with, William Jett. Is he the one that brought the posse to the Garrett farm?
Well, yeah, he's the one that, supposedly, but there's long been a question of how this posse just happened to, go almost directly to exactly where Booth and Harold supposedly were. This manhunt had been going on for like 12 days and, as I said, there were just thousands and thousands of people involved and they had combed the countryside with a fine-tooth comb, and then these Baker cousins, who were very closely connected to Stanton and Stanton's War Department and whatnot, were dispatched, to bring these people in and just sort of magically just knew exactly where to go, right out of the gate. And, when questioned about it, he claimed that Luther Baker, the guy who was kind of running this operation, or Lafayette, Luther Baker, who was a cousin of Lafayette Baker, he claimed that he got a tip from, quote-unquote, an old Negro, but no such person ever stepped forward to claim the substantial rewards that were offered for this information leading to his capture, which raised a lot of questions. And again, a congressional committee questioned that and said, you know, questioned how it was that this this specially formed posse just seemed to happen to know exactly where to go to capture these people who had eluded capture for almost 2 weeks from you know, thousands of other law enforcement personnel who were searching for them. And these were questions that were raised in our congressional subcommittee about how he managed to do that. And some of the language in the reports released by I don't know if you read that through the notes there towards the end, but some of the statements released by this congressional committee were just staggering in how blunt they were.
I know.
Talking about, I mean, you would never read that kind of stuff now in a, you know, I mean, one of the things they said about him was, we don't believe that this guy has ever told the truth in his life, even by accident.
Right.
And the American people in the history will be appalled to learn that such a despicable man held their liberties in the palm, you know. And I mean, just the language is just extraordinary, you know. I mean, you would never, ever read that in a congressional report released nowadays, you know, those kind of remarks made about a sitting administration official or whatever, you know. I mean, it was just remarkable how frank and blunt they were in, you know, dragging this guy over the coals about how he came to, you know, came by this information and,
right,
and managed to capture this guy that nobody else could capture.
Right, and he basically says this guy's the biggest liar ever. He couldn't tell the truth even by accident. And yet people still bought it.
Basically, the guy, you cannot believe anything that this guy says. Not a word out of him. Yeah, they were very skeptical of his story of how he captured Booth, and very skeptical that it was, in fact, Booth.
Right, well then.
You know, and this was a congressional committee. This wasn't, you know, a bunch of
crazy
conspiracy theorists on the radio, you know.
It wasn't the Warren Commission. You have one quote from Senator Garrett Davis of Kentucky, which he gave in the U.S. Senate in 1866. He said, "I've never seen myself any satisfactory evidence that Booth was killed." I mean, how much clearer do you need to get?
And then one of the other senators responded by saying, well, you know, some things you just have to take on faith, and or some, you know, words to that effect, some things, you know, we just have to accept on faith from our government or whatever. And, well, no, we don't.
Right.
We want to see proof, and there's no reason why the government couldn't have provided that proof.
Well, they still won't provide proof on anything that happens in this country now, from Sandy Hook to 9/11 to you name it. You know, to Bin Laden floating in the ocean. You know, we're just supposed to take their word for it because we're just, you know, a nation of lemmings. There was, what the heck, where was I going with this? Wasn't there also, though, obviously some Americans that were awake and had a thinking brain, didn't they start screaming around D.C., this is a hoax, a demanding truth?
According to some of the accounts, there was almost immediately an uproar from the people and a lot of talk around Washington that, you know, this story just reeked.
Right.
And that, you know, people were very skeptical.
They could have been our first conspiracy theorists in America.
You know, I mean, they wanted to see proof, you know.
We had a right to.
You know, show us the body. Show us a photograph.
Show us the steel.
Bring out some family members who will confirm that it was, in fact, you know, they wanted to see some proof. And the government still to this day never provided it.
And still won't, no matter what happens. We still don't ever see any evidence. Dave, I got to tell you, this story is getting better as you go along. I can't wait for the next install. So I want to thank you.
I can't wait to get back to it. I've really missed working on it these last couple of months, and I'm really very anxious to get back working on it.
Well, you will. I hear your little pup barking in the background. So thanks for joining me today, Dave. And I'll talk to you next. I said thanks for joining me today. I'll talk to you next month.
Well, thanks for having me once again. Yeah, I guess I got to go tend to my dog.
Go take care of your pup. Okay.
She's still trying to get used to her new surroundings.
Well, you know, moves are traumatic for our pets, too. So go take care of your pup.
It's been rough. It's been as rough on her as it has been on me, so I've had to spend a lot of extra time with her the last couple of weeks, just reassuring her that everything's still okay.
Everything is. All right, Dave. Well, you take care, and I'll talk with you soon.
All right, you too.
All right, bye. Dave McGowan. Bye. Check out his work at davesweb.cnchost.com. His Moon series is there. His series on Boston bombings is there. His series on 9/11 is there. And what we've got so far on his Lincoln series. Thanks again for listening and supporting the show. If you're not a subscriber, please consider a subscription or a donation. That keeps the show not only pure, but all those annoying commercial free that you hear on everybody else's show. So thanks again for listening. I'll see you guys next time.
Thank you for listening and supporting the Maria Show. Tell others what you learned today. Knowledge becomes wisdom only when it's shared. Encourage others to subscribe today. www.maria.net. Often imitated, never duplicated. A world of information all in one place. www.maria.net. Always ahead of the curve. Always on your side. Get active or get radioactive. Subscribe today.